is the internal mechanism for the password server, how is that intended to work? So, any of those, but what did you get? What did you do? Would you mind shutting that door? I can't hear very well from back there.
There are a lot of number definitions PW server. Just kind of got all those in there and then started working on the default construct. And I guess if you pull the...
Well, the deep, there is no default construct. Does it serve? No, no default construct. The only construct it has is the one that takes files, two file name parameters, and a maximum number of users. And what it's supposed to do is store those two file names as string objects for later reference. Store max users, variable for later. Those are all three class variables, private class variables. And then it does all that with an initialization list. Then it proceeds to open the input file, read the number of users out of the top of that file, and use that to delimit a loop, which will read username and signature pairs, first username and signature, the number of times it's listed in the top of the file, and store those in a vector, which has got to be a vector of widgets. You have to take these username and signatures and put them in a single object so that it could be a vector element. So that's how it starts up. And you're guaranteed that those things are going to be read in alpha order of username, which means your vector will start out ordered. The reason you're guaranteed that it starts out ordered is that was created by a previous password server, which saved the file out of that vector. So the vector order is maintained by the password server. Whenever somebody's added, inserted, it's inserted in correct order. And so it just stays in order. So that's how it starts up. Any question about that? And the way it shuts down is it saves its internal data to the output file. So that's the destructor. Now, I should say in passing that whenever the internal data of the password server changes, it's supposed to open the output file, write that new data to that output file, and then close the output file. So that the new data is always on record in that file as soon as possible. And be sure you close it again so that other entities would have access to the file. Because that happens in the destructor and in the change password and in the create user and in the delete user, all four of those change the data and therefore induce a write. It's good to isolate the write password file into a private member function that can be called by all four of those other methods. So anyway, then you go back. That pretty much takes care of the startup and shutdown. Then the question is, how do you operate one of the methods? Simplest one to think about is check password. Now, I'll tell you the logic that my solution follows, which is not exactly the same as the logic. It accomplishes the same thing in a slightly different logical pattern from the one in the document here. What I did is I have a protected private method called hash with a capital H. And I have a private method called locate. Locate takes one parameter, which is a string object. It's a UID. But it could as well, perhaps an even better design would have locate take a single parameter, which is one of those widget objects. But in either case, what locate does is effectively follow the lower bound algorithm from binary search. But instead of returning a value, it places the value that it finds in another private class member variable. So that there's persistent memory of the location, so you don't have to keep calling locate every time you need to know where the thing is. You need to know it maybe two or three times in each one of these public methods. And the hash, what hash does is you got to give it two parameters in some form. One is the user ID, and the other is the input user password. And I believe what I did is pass those in as char stars. So I'm operating on not my copies of those two things, but on the copies that were supplied by the client program. And those come in, one is a const char star and one is just a char star. What my hash function does is concatenate those two strings. And what I do is the simplest way to do that is internally convert them to string objects. By the way, as soon as you've converted the UPW to a string object, what I do, the very next thing I do is overwrite UPW with some kind of blanking out character. Before I do anything else, I make a local variable string object copy of the user password, and then I immediately obliterate the string that is that password, which came in from the client program. The client program has given me permission to do that by virtue of handing me the pointer through a non-const char star variable. Anyway, so now I've got these two string objects. You can then add them with the plus operator, and that gives you a concatenated string object that's really the first one plus glued to the second one. User ID plus user password. Then I take #function and apply it to that new concatenated string object. That gives me my hash value, and that's the value that I return. And as I return, the two string objects I created go out of scope. And to be ultra safe, I should probably again obliterate the data in the user password string object before I let it go out of scope. Otherwise, it will be sitting around in released memory with the password. But all those just things I did, you know, that's not part of the requirements. So what that hash function does is take those two parameters inside, create string objects out of them, add them together, run it through #_function, which is in the library, and return the value computed as the signature, as a secure signature. So how would then check password go? Remember, this is just the server. So there's three parameters. There's two parameters passed in, username and user password, as char stars. First thing you would do is call hash function for those two parameters. That gives you the hash, the signature, and save the result of that in some local variable, the signature. And in the act of doing that, you have obliterated all the copies you know about of the open clear text password. As an aside, that's again not necessary, but I did that. So, okay, the second step is to look up through the locate function this to see whether this UID is in the vector. So a call to locate will tell you where it ought to be, but it doesn't tell you it's necessarily there. Now, the place where it ought to be is going to be in some range between 0 and the number of users, inclusive. The lower bound algorithm, you know, can return one past the last legitimate element as a value, as an index value. When it does that, it means it tells you that it didn't find it, and if you wanted to insert it, you have to put it at the back end of all the others, because it's bigger than all the others. So you call locate, it tells you where it ought to be by placing the value in the index parameter. And then the first thing you have to do is check to see if that index parameter is a legitimate index by checking it against the number of users. If it's equal to the number of users, then you immediately know that you didn't find that user in the vector in the database, so therefore you return the 0. If it's in the legitimate range, then you check the vector element there to see if that user is equal to the usernames are equal. Because again, just because you it doesn't mean that they're necessarily equal. It just means this is where it ought to be if it were in there. You got to check to see if the usernames are equal. If the usernames are equal, then you check to see if the signature you computed is equal to the signature that's stored with that username. And finally, then, if it passes the index in range test followed by the username is found test followed by the signature stored equals the signature computed test, then you return a 1 because that's your authentication.
Now, searching algorithm for the linear search, that's what we have to implement?
Yeah, it gives the lower bound code, the code for lower bound.
How do we put that in our CPP file? That's the way I got hung up when I was looking for it in T-Vector.
No, it's you're going to have to make it specific to your application. What did you decide to call the vector where you're storing things and things like that. So, but it'll be, yeah, that'll be the implementation of the locate function, basically. Okay. Now, how that works is in the slides, but you'll have to make sure the code is tailored to your specific needs in that search. Okay. So anyway, if it passes all the tests, you return a 1. If at any point it fails one of those tests, you return a 0. And that's the check password. Change password would go through exactly the same set of... Change password takes 3 parameters. It goes through the same set with the first 2 parameters until it got down to the... essentially completed the authentication, and then it would write the new signature to the correct place in the vector, and then before returning a 1, it would rewrite the output file. Open out the file, write it, and close it because it's changed its data. And then it would return 1. Again, if any time it fails something, it would return 0 and not do anything. Now, the create user and delete user. There's not really an authentication involved in those, but there is an insert in the vector involved, and that insert is, well, it's an insert or remove, and in either case, you know, that's that, you put something in the middle of a vector, it's sort of, you've got to do a bunch of copying to make room for it. But again, that you know where to put a new user. Let's talk about insert or new insert user. First, you got to calculate the signature, right? They're going to give you a username, password. Calculate the signature just so for if it were an authentication. Then you look up the user in the call locate for that user. Locate will return an index. If that index is a valid index, check to see what's there. If that user is already there, then you return a 0. You can't create a new user with the same username that's already there. If that user is not there, then you insert the new user, comma, signature at that location in the vector. And to make room for it, that means you've got to increment the number of users currently in the system, and then copy, starting at the top end of the users, copy each user widget up one vector index. And do that marching from the back of the vector, the top index, all the way down to and including the place where you need to insert the new user. that's what I mean by the leapfrog copy. That just basically spreads the data out to make room for a place to copy in this new user in the vector. And you're doing it at the lower bound location, which guarantees the order, the sorted order of the vector is maintained by this process. Delete user, it's a similar thing, except you got to locate it with a locate, and then you've got to do a leapfrog copy of other. First, make sure that location is that user, and if it is, do that leapfrog copy downward, starting at that location out through the end of the vector, and decrement the number of users. Return a one. You return a one whenever the operation is successful, and a zero when it's not successful. And that's the sole means by which the server communicates with the outside world. Now, it's usually good, it's almost always a good idea to play with the test programs that I supply. Just gives you a feel for how this is supposed to work. Actually, I'm going to not do it here, though, because I don't have my data files there in that correct. It would be easier just to build a project here and do it there. Okay, now, this thing came to life and presented me with the menu. That was pretty quick processing, but remember, we'd had to do a few things. It had to dump here. It had to store that, the name of the input file, store the name of the output file, store the maximum number of users. That has to be the size of the vector I'm using. The actual number of users is 11, and that was read from the input file, PWF1. And it was read into this user data. By the way, I don't know if I've mentioned it, or you figured it out, but password is always the same as the username in these examples, so you can know what the passwords are. Okay? And notice here that the location is port 29077-1288. What does that tell you? That it didn't get initialized. I haven't called locate yet for any purpose, so you know, there was never an initialization of that variable. But anyway, that's how the password server came to life. So we could, the public stuff is, actually, let me, I'm removing the output file. I'm going to do that again. Okay, so notice this. I'm going to display my output file. I haven't, the password server has not had any reason to write to the output file yet because it hasn't been destroyed. It hasn't called its destructor and no data has changed. Nothing's been done. So if I try to look at that file, it's going to tell me it can't open. Now I'm going to check some passwords here. Just check password for locker accepted. Check password for locker and mistype the password. User denied. Extra doofus. Extra doofus. Accepted. So let's try some other stuff. We can change password. I'm going to change password from locker to locker. Of course, that's a different password. Oops. I didn't look at my screen, did I? I'm going to dump first anyway, so I'm going to change password. If I can type better, I'll be getting this done faster. Old password's that. New password will be that. Notice 39884 was the signature before change. Now it's 35067. I want to show something else. I'm going to change the password for Porter. Old password is Porter. New password is going to be capital L-A-C-H-E-R, the same as Locker's password. Locker is 35067. Porter is 13126. No way for Porter or Locker to realize that they happen to be using the same password. And that comes from the fact we concatenated the username in there before we calculated the signature.
Can I see the syntax you use to compile that?
Do what now?
How did you compile the test file? What file are you running right there?
I'm running the pwtest.x.
Yeah, but you have to compile CPP to get the .x, right?
Right.
And I'm messing up the syntax for compiling.
Well, I mean, you could. I compile it with a make file. So, but the point is, you can't make this executable without the password server on it.
So we can't execute it.
You can execute it because I've distributed the executable. But you can't create your own executable until you have a password server object to use as part of the compilation. Okay, you follow me?
Yeah.
So I want to show you now. There's the menu. I'm going to display the output file. Notice about to say, notice that it now displays. But it didn't. So I don't know what happened. It's supposed to display now because it should have been written whenever this number 2 was called to change passwords. It should have created that output file.
What's the difference between the two files?
One's an output file, one's an input file.
Like that's PWF1 and PWF2 we're always going to have to update PWF1 because that's the master file, right? Or
no, you never update PWF1. You only update PWF2. PWF1 is only used to input data.
Right.
PWF2 is used to output data.
Okay. But there is essentially, they're the same. Physically, they're the same file.
No, they're different files.
Well, then next time you open PWF1, how are you? You're not getting your modified.
Well, now remember, those are just parameters. The question is, how would this be used?
Right.
The way it would probably, a way to use it would be every night at midnight, close down the password server. Copy PWF1 to an archive with a date on it, and that would have been the startup file for that day, and copy PWF2 to PWF1 and restart it.
So every time you open up PWF1, it's never going to be changed.
Right.
Okay.
You can change it by just copying PWF2 to PWF1, and then okay. You got the new one.
So when we go and like change password or create a user, it's never changing PWF1.
It'll change in PWF2, and then you can move that back to PWF1 and restart it, and it'll have the new data. Oh, I see. Right. See that N1.clear? That has to be added here as well because I have a break. Things have gotten more sensitive to the clear, what that does is clear the error flags. Once the error flags get set in a stream, they stay set. And this stream object that's being used by PWTest is, it's using the same object over and over again, and so you got to clear the flags out, or it won't. It'll think it's failed and can't reopen anything. Let's try that again now. Create a user this time. Notice I deleted PWF2, so it doesn't exist. I'm going to create a new user, and let's give it the name Clayton. Password Clayton. Now let's dump. See if Mr. Clayton is there. There he is. Now let's check, see if we can look at the output file. We can. The output file got created, opened, written to, and closed by the call, by the password server, not by this client program, but by the server. It got created the first time a new user got added. The first time there was any change in the data, it got created.
The second file.
Is that right?
He added one, and it got created. But it also it got created and contained everything from the first one as well.
It just contains a copy of what's in the current server internally.
Hey, when you just added one, you removed that file with PW2. You took that out. Okay, you added one. Created PW2 again, right? In a PW file, it has everything from PW1 or just from what you just...
Well, it happens to, but it's not required to have everything.
It's required
to have everything that's currently correct. So, for example, if I call delete user, then that'll remove that user and rewrite that file, and that'll be a name that's in PW1, but not in PW2.
Say that again.
All right, suppose I delete user. Let me delete.
You delete a user that's not PW2, but is in PW1.
Well, whether it's, let me. Delete user is going to be 4. I'm going to delete locker. Goodbye. Okay, so my output file now looks like this. Of course, the file, it's basically just a copy of the dump, right? The dump looks like this. This is the internal structure. And the, in a vector. The external file, it's got 11 users. That's who they are. Notice locker's not in there. Of course, locker still is in. PWF1, that was a file used to initialize this group. So this would be, this PWF1 would be a valid record of the exact set of users and their signatures that was correct at exactly 12 midnight today. This morning, 12 a.m. this morning.
They both say 11, which means.
Huh?
They both say 11.
Well, I added Porter. No, I added Clayton over here.
Okay.
Same size because I added Clayton, but I deleted Locker. See, that's Clayton. And there's Locker for Clayton over here. What I want to show you in the dump here, by the way, the location A, that's the location of the last call that was made to the locate method. And notice that was right here. What was the last thing I did was delete locker, right? Well, that was the position locker was in before he got deleted. That Miss Porter before, I'll put locker back and you just leave where locker used to be. Locker was at 8. When I added, what Porter I added, it was quite. Forgotten what I did now, but look, suppose I check Clayton. Let me just check Clayton's password. And dump, and you'll see that the result of the search was 2, which is where I found Clayton. Suppose I search for a user, Zebra. That user is denied, mainly because that user doesn't exist. Note where the location is. It's 12, which is the first place past the end of the legitimate range. That's the place where if I had to put Zebra in, it would go there. So that's the case where your lower bound search returns the one past the end index, which is why you have to be careful to check that it's valid before you start dereferencing that index. Am I helping you out, sir?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions about the password server? There's some technical details that you don't think to ask about. You can't think to ask about until you stumble upon them. There are three technical details that warrant discussion, other than the ones I've already mentioned. Four, if you count. Don't forget that the index returned by locate might be one past the end of legitimate user reach. You always have to take that into account. And also don't forget that even if it returns a valid index, it doesn't mean it found the user. It just means that found where that user ought to be if it's there. So technical details. Two sets of technical details have to do with the different types containing essentially the same information. And what you're going to find in this project is there's strings, C strings floating around. In particular, the way this thing receives parameters from the outside world, from the client programs, is in the form of C strings. That is to say, pointers to type character. And this is done purely to accommodate the way typical systems are built up, with people slapping together some C code and run the terminals and things like that. It's also sort of handy in a way to get past a pointer, because that means that, in a sense, the server, don't have the responsibility for that data. You're getting past a pointer to somebody else's data, as opposed to having to take responsibility for it when it's passed in. So, on the other hand, internally, this server is going to try to deal with string objects as much as possible. So you're going to find yourself needing to convert C strings to string objects often. Now, that can happen two ways typically. One is implicitly and one is explicitly. Implicitly, there is a constructor for string objects that takes a C string as a parameter. If you have a string object S paren, declared S paren, and then give it some C string as a parameter, it will build a string object in the likeness of that C string that was passed it as a parameter. So that means you can do incredibly handy things like in the constructor for password server initialization list, it takes these three parameters, const, char, star, filename 1, const, char, star, filename 2, and I forget it, but it's an unsigned int or a size type, num users or max users. You can initialize, if you've got private data items called that are of type FSU double colon string, that's a string object now. That's a proper type. One of these is called, let's say, infile, and one is called outfile. You can initialize these two gizmos here with just simple in the initialization list, infile paren F1 comma outfile paren F2. And this is something that's just way easier than the sort of stuff you have to do with C string. If these were C string, you couldn't do it in the init list. You'd have to get in the body, figure out how long these things are, ask for that much memory, and then do an strcpy of one into the other. But this is taken care of because it's a proper type. I guess you could go ahead and put max users max here, and that would initialize a bunch of things before you even get into the body of that constructor. The other place where you have technically different types representing essentially the same information is in the widget objects versus the components of the widget. So the widget object, remember, consists of two things. The user ID, which is FSU string object, and the user signature, which is an unsigned integer. That's the thing I thought we would call it UID SGN or something like that. Allow me to use the word widget. It's easier.
When you say widget, is that a term you made up, or is that?
That's a term that people often use for a class that we're talking about, and it hasn't been particularly well defined. Just so it has no technical overtones. It's just a class. So anyway, the widget object is like a pair of things, which one of which is a string object, one of which is an unsigned integer object. And so you can have the user name being represented as a C string, which is the way it comes in as a parameter, it can be converted to a string object, and then it can be the first component of a widget, so it can kind of exist at three different levels, technically, in the program. And you, if you use the wrong representation, then the whatever use you're trying to make will issue a compiler or induce a compiler. So you have to be careful about that. So that's the technical issue of getting things to be the right type of what you want to do. Now the widget thing will have appropriate constructors so that you can make widget objects very easily with two parameters, one of which is a string object and one of which is a number. So you can make a widget pretty easily. And don't forget that the widget has overloaded, you have to overload the less than operator and the equality operator. These are trivial to do, but they have to be done because the compiler can't make up the definition for you. And the way you make these things up is you, for example, a widget object less than operator says that two widgets, one is less than the other, if the first widget's username is less than the second widget's username. And that's important because the vector has to maintain order, and you have to use that order in your locate function. And so widgets, all those things need to know how to compare two widgets with a less than operator. Yes.
In the binary search, like on a PW server, it only has two parameters, but lower bound has three parameters.
Right. Well, you can even get your binary search down to one parameter. No, you're not missing anything. You have to use the code for the lower bound algorithm, but you have to tailor it to your particular environment here. And your particular environment here is you know what the vector is that you're searching, but you don't have to name it. It's a data member of the class, so it doesn't need to be named at all. And you also know the lower and upper bounds of your search. The lower bound of your search is zero. I mean, the lower range boundary is zero. The upper range boundary is num users, not the current number of users.
Right.
So that doesn't need to be passed in. The only thing you really need to pass in to locate is the user you're trying to look up. Now you can pass that, you could write this two ways. You could write locate where it takes a user as a string object, user ID as a string object. And then what locate would have to do is first stick that into a widget. So let's talk about that particular way of writing the locate. This is going to be a void, which, again, we don't have to have a return value because we've got a class variable that's placed to put computed value. It doesn't have to return anything. So locate really only needs to take one parameter, which is, for all practical purposes, some designation of the user ID that you're trying to look at. So let's say that it's a FSU string object called UID. And the idea is it's supposed to use the lower bound process to compute the index for where this ought to be. The complicating factor comes in with the type problem that I was talking about earlier. The vector doesn't have UIDs in it. It's got widgets in it. So if you try to look up a UID in a vector that doesn't contain UIDs, you're not going to get it. So the first thing you got to do is make a widget. Widget And let's call it W. And we'll use its two parameter constructor. UID will be its first parameter. And the second parameter has got to be an unsigned integer. Zero is a pretty good one. We'll just use zero. Then what you do here is go through the lower bound process. Lower bound algorithm right there. And then when you finish with that, there's this, you know, that's a loop. It starts out while, let's see, I guess it's going to have unsigned or size type low equals zero, mid and high equal num user, right? And then it's going to have a loop that says while low is less than high, do stuff. And then down here, low equals high, right? And that's the thing that in the version that's in the slides, you would return low right here. But we don't return it. What we do is we set location equal low. Location is our class variable where we're going to store that information, the result of the search. You follow that, Ryan?
Where did location come from?
It's a class variable. And so one call to locate for a given UID is permanently, persistently stores the result of the search in the location variable, and that won't change until you make another call to locate, which you won't do during a particular implementation. So now you know where this user ought to be because it's been stored in location. You can see how that's supposed to work by running the executable that I've supplied. Okay? Copy it into your project directory and run it with the input data file. And actually do a password check and see what location ends up, how it ends up being defined. You can always see that by hitting the dump. Dump gives you a complete picture of what all of the private variables look like in the server. Now you may recall that there's a check in here that has to do with a less than operator. This less than operator here, low less than high, is the one for integers. Right? Those are size type parameters. But down inside of here, you do something like a mid equals, what is it, low plus high over 2? Then you do if. Now, what vector are we searching is the vector that I've suggested you call user. So you check here, user. I've forgotten what the check is. Somebody tell me. Is it user of mid?
Mid left.
Is less than the search item, which is not UID, but it's this widget W. This is the call to the less than operator for the widget class. And that's the one you have to define. And it's going to boil down to just alphabetical order in the user ID. But the compiler's not going to be smart enough to figure that out unless you tell it. So you, when you're doing your widget implementation, you've got this, you've got to do operator less than, and actually I guess this is going to be global, operator less than, we're going to have it return an int, which we think of as a boolean, leaves a 0 or 1, and it takes with const widget reference as each parameter, say W1 and W2, and you can do this in just one line. It's return W1 dot UID is less than W2 dot UID.
That's in PW server, right?
That would be where you, yeah, it'd be
PW server colon colon.
Or no, that I think that would be. No, that's. I can't remember. Do we have namespaces in this project? Did I say anything about namespaces? I didn't think I did. No. So this is a global operator. This is the less than operator defined globally for class widget. It's listed as a friend of widget. The reason it's listed as a friend of widget is because right here you're accessing private data for the widgets. Frankly, you know, you could simplify this by making the data in widgets public, and then you don't have to write your set and get functions, and this doesn't have to be a friend. You can just access the data with the dot notation. But in any case, that's basically how you transform the less than operator from knowing how to do it for the user IDs to knowing how to do it for widgets. The equality and the non-equality operator also use exactly the same process. Look at the user ID only, ignore the signature. The output operator, I think, also needs to be overloaded for widgets. And of course, when you output a widget, you probably want to output. You want to output both. And what I did is output first w1.uid and then a tab and then w1.sgn or whatever you call it. First output the user ID and then the signature for the tab in between.
How does it know what UID is? Is that the
user, a widget is nothing but a UID paired with a signature. That's all it is. It's just a pair of pieces of information. like to look at the calendar. The week we have here is this one, week 6. Chapter 8 on lists we talked about last week. What I would like to talk about next is Project 2, Ring Buffer. Simply because that project is due in 2 weeks. Well, roughly 2 weeks. 2 weeks from Sunday. So it's got, I realize that since you're just finishing up a project, it's sort of hard to start wrapping your mind around another project. But I would like to introduce that project to you now. So it won't be a full week before I get to talk to you about it. Well, this still says draft open for comment. I guess Sunday night, I'll remove that statement. If you've got any comments on this, it'd be good to do them before then. This project name is Ring Buffer. Educational objectives are experiencing and implementing and testing dynamic data structures using pointers. Experience implementing and using linked structures, abstract lists, and abstract iterators. Your operational objectives are to supply source code implementing the template class Ring Buffer and the template class Ring Buffer Iterator. Code should be thoroughly tested for functional correctness, robustness, and memory management. The supplied code should function correctly and be free of memory leaks, and your test should provide evidence of both. The evidence should be summarized in a test report. The deliverables are your ringbuff.cpp and your testreport.txt. That's going to be a text file once you submit your report. Note that ringbuff.cpp will be a slave file for the ringbuff.h header file. Ringbuff.cpp will not compile to object code as it stands because it is template code. It is a slave file, ringbuff.h. Ringbuff.h will include ringbuff.cpp into it so that when you want to use a ring buffer in a client program, all you do is include the header file and everything is automatically brought in. Just the way it works with list and vector.
So when you make it, you shouldn't have the ringbuff.cpp and that they call it on?
No, you pretend that you don't know it's there. You just include the header file. It's pretty much a hard and fast rule. Never include a .cpp file into another code file. That is for I think the way I put it on the discussion board is to make a class project. I'm not sure which course I posted this in. I've got too many courses. And that was intended to be ambiguous because this is a class, right? We can also think of it as class as in high class. Make a classy project. You don't want to have code files included into other code files. That creates code file dependencies that are bug producers. They make software engineering difficult, etc. Occasionally, we include code files into test program code files just to have a quick and dirty way to compile a test program. Occasionally we allow ourselves that, the luxury of not having to make separate object files. But whenever you're doing a real project, you want to do it the right way. Don't include code files into other code files. Now, what do you do with those .cpp files? If they are code files themselves, then you compile them separately in the object code. And then be sure you supply the object code to the linker when you get ready to make the executable. If they are templates, then they're slave files and are supposed to be included into the header files that define them. So either way, they get treated differently in your make file, but either way, they never get included into other source code.
So when you say compile them separately, you're saying they're two separate make files?
No, two separate lines in a make file.
In the same make file.
Right. Now, so let's talk a little bit about what is a ring buffer. It's a specific type of implementation of the abstract data type queue, which we're about to talk about. It's got an associated iterator class. The abstract data type queue does not have iterators, but ring buffers will have iterators. Now, I'll say right up front, it's unusual and out of sync with the notion of abstract data type to imply implementation details with the naming of your structure. When we call it a ring buffer, there's a certain implication of how this is implemented, namely, like a ring, right? And there's just such a long tradition to the word ring buffer and what it's meant since the old C days and beyond, and maybe before even, that we just kind of stick with that term. Ring buffers are used in a number of applications, typically to store keyboard input temporarily at a terminal location and before a send command is issued. So if we imagine you're sitting at a terminal, and a terminal these days often means some sort of process as opposed to a piece of hardware. So when you open up an SSH session into shell, that's a terminal. When you type on the keyboard, the letters appear on the screen. Those letters are being stored somewhere. They're not being stored by the screen, obviously. They're stored in a ring buffer. When you hit the enter key is when that ring buffer sends its stored stuff to the process that is expecting to receive it, which would be some sort of operating system. Receive. So when you type, there's got to be a place for stuff to be stored before you hit the enter key. The enter key is what depletes the storage buffer and sends it to the operating system. A ring buffer is a handy device for terminals, and they are the structure of choice, in fact, for terminals. One of the things you'll notice in a terminal application is you can type letters in, and you can go back and modify what you typed by using, let's say, in some cases, the arrow keys. You move the arrow, move back, and maybe change two letters back, change it to some other letter, correct spelling, or something like that. What that implies is that there's got to be iterator support for the ring buffer. So you have to be able to get back to a character down deep in the ring buffer somewhere and do things to it. And in a queue, which has no iterator associated with it, you can't do that. And with a queue, all you can do is push and pop and access the front. So you can put stuff in a queue, take it out, and access the front. But everything that's in the queue, you can't look at it. You can't know what it is. It's just, an opaque container. But with a ring buffer, it's got all the properties of being a queue plus an iterator that'll let you go to elements in there and dereference and see what they are. And in fact, it'll return a non-const reference, so it'll allow you to change the item if you need to. So a ring buffer would be the an essential feature of the internal workings of a terminal program. So, the ring buffer interface, let's talk about it. As I said, it's going to be an implementation of the abstract data type queue with iterator support and modified nomenclature. And the modified nomenclature is going to be expressed here. So the nomenclature for ring buffer is going to have, well, first of all, it's going to have a ring buffer iterator as a friend, which is pretty typical of container classes. We've already seen that with list. List and list iterator are mutual friends of each other. Ring buffer and ring buffer iterator are going to be mutual friends of each other. And that's going to be typical of any container class and its associated iterator type. There's going to be typically terminology support, defining the term value type and the term iterator inside the scope of ring buffer. There's going to be a default constructor parameterless, a destructor, copy constructor, and an assignment operator. That's going to be the way you get elements into a ring buffer is with the pushback operation. The model being it's a queue, right? Push to the back of the queue. That's like the regular queue push operation. The pop front is like the regular queue pop operation. You pop from front of the buffer. Clear is to empty the buffer, and release is going to be to release the buffer memory. Now hang on to those because notice it says C notes 1, C note 2, C note 3, C note 4, C note 5, C note 6. There's a bunch of implementation notes in the header file, which is distributed for your use. So you have size, returns the number of elements currently in the buffer. Capacity will return the number of memory positions available. Empty will return true if and only if the buffer has no elements. There's going to be two versions of front, a const version which returns a const reference, and a non-const version which returns a non-const reference. Notice that there is no back. And locating places on the buffer, begin will return an iterator to the first element in the buffer, and end will return an iterator one past the last in the buffer. And dump is going to show you a picture of the buffer. ring buffer iterator. It's a mutual friend of the ring buffer, as I said. You're going to define value type and iterator, terminology support, default constructor, copy constructor, and just like with list, you can define a ring buffer iterator initialized to a given ring buffer by passing that ring buffer. We're going to have a retrieve and a valid. And a dereference. We're going to have equals, equality, inequality, dereference, assignment, and prefix and postfix increment. Notice that I don't have a decrement. So this iterator could be compactly described as a forward iterator. It has most of the capabilities of the list iterator, except it can't back up. It can only go forward. Now, let's start talking about the implementation plan. We're going to use a collection of links created dynamically to store the data. One data item per link, each link pointing to a following link. It's analogous to the linked list implementation we use for TList. But there is the difference that in TList, a link has a next pointer and a prev pointer. Next going to the next link, prev pointing to the previous link. In ring buffer, we only have the next pointer. We don't have the prev pointer. So in ring buffer, you can only go forward through the pointer system, not backward. Which sort of explains why the iterator can't back up. But this is going to be, so there are some analogies here with linked lists, but there are also some differences. One difference is that a ring buffer will not release the memory associated with a link on the delete operation. You recall last week when we were talking about list, when you delete an item from the list, when you remove an item from the list, you end up deleting the link that contained it. So the number of links allocated in a linked list is the same as the number of items stored on. With a ring buffer, we're not going to do that. We're going to, once we allocate a link, we're going to keep it. And even if the buffer gets smaller, we're going to keep the allocated link out there. So there has to be another way to keep track of where beginning and the end of our actual buffer is. And I'll talk about that in just a second. Let me give you the first picture of the implementation plan. The ring buffer carrier is going to be some private allocated data. The carrier ring is going to be this collection of links, and they are oriented, each pointing to the next, but we always initialize that with having the last one point back to the first one. So when we first create a ring buffer, we make sure that it has at least two links, and that if you follow the pointers around, you eventually come back to where you started. So they're always oriented, always, it's always a circular path. Starting anywhere in that collection of links, you can keep following the links around and you eventually get back to where you started. So that's the so-called carrier ring. Now the data that the, and by the way, that those are really dynamically allocated links, and so they're just sort of off in memory somewhere. Not really enclosed in the footprint of the class, just like with a link. Data of your ring buffer is going to maintain two pointers, just like list maintain two pointers. But list uses those two pointers to point to the first and the last links, and these things were oriented like a list, right? They weren't oriented like a circle. With a ring buffer, you have a first used pointer and a first free pointer. The first use pointer points to the first use means that's the first link that I'm using as part of my buffer. And the first free pointer points to the first link that is not part of the buffer. So from first used up to but not including first free is your buffer. So for example, suppose that's the setup and you issue a pop front. Then all the ring buffer has to do is move its first used pointer to the next link. And just say, okay, I'm not going to use that one. I was just out. I'm going to move to the next one. It doesn't delete it or anything. It just leaves it sitting there, but it's no longer part of the buffer. Push back, well, it's an element. We'll take the value and put it where the first free points, and then increment in that sense, go to the next link with first free. Note that neither one of those involves a call to operator new. It's just manipulating, just a few lines of code with an assignment statement, a couple of assignment statements in it. Very fast code. Only time pushback will result in a memory allocation is when the carrier ring is full. The way you know that the carrier ring is full is if the first free arrow next. So the next one after the first free one is the first used one. That's how you will detect if the carrier ring is full. So there's always going to be, in other words, one link that is not used. And it's the thing that separates the beginning from the end of the actual buffer. But the link that is not used isn't always the same link. Can float around in the ring depending on the sequence of pushes and pops. Furthermore, there might be lots of links between the end of the buffer and the beginning of the buffer. All we're saying is it has to be one. So if you ever get down to the point where there's only one free link and you got a push back command, that's when you have to take a timeout, allocate a new link, and lace it into the ring. But with a pop front, you never deallocate the memory. So if you build a ring up and it's got 245 links in it, and you do some pops, taking it down to 150, you leave all those 245 links allocated. That gives you room to expand and contract the size of your buffer without doing any memory management at all. Now, memory management is slow. Call to operator new, even for something small like a link, takes a lot of time. First of all, remember that's a request to the operating system. So you've got to issue a request, and then you've got to do it on, you know, operating system time. And the operating system might have what it considers to be more important things going on. Think jobs that it has to do that have a higher priority than your silly little program. That's the way the operating system thinks. Its stuff is the most important. So you're subject to delays of unknown lengths when you make a call to new. So you, if you want something to run fast, you try to not be making calls to new and delete all the time. That's what the, that's the idea behind this ring buffer. You want to, once you have to make an allocation, you conserve it and keep reusing it instead of deallocating it and then requesting it again when you need it again. Are y'all going to ask me this question again? I'll tell you how you, after you've had a chance to think about it. But how do you detect an empty buffer? Notice that's not the same thing as an empty carrier ring. You could have 250 links in a carrier ring and nothing in the buffer. First used equals first free is how you know that. So if the first used pointer and the first free pointer point to the same link, then you got nothing in the buffer. Pushback would put something at that location and increment the first free to the next, and then you'd have a buffer with one element in it. There's another possible case is you might have an empty or a null carrier. Let's say that a carrier is null if there are no links in it. Obviously, if there's no links, then also you have an empty buffer. It just so happens that when there's no links, it, the last link and the first link are equal because they're both equal to zero. So the same test will work to detect both of those situations if you set things up right. So suppose you've got, so let's just think about one of these carriers, one of these buffers comes to life. It starts up, it has nothing in it, obviously, but it also has no carrier ring, has a null carrier ring. So the very first push operation has to create a carrier ring to work with and store that piece of data. So the push back operation has to check first for an empty carrier. If the carrier is empty, then it has to create two links. One to store its data, and one to be free. But remember, we said that if you have a non, if the carrier ring, if it's null, has to have at least one free link, one link that hasn't been used as part of the buffer. So the very first push operation on an empty carrier ring has to create two links one for the data item and one to be free. And the one to be free gets pointed to by first free, and the one to have the data item gets pointed to by first used. From then on, anytime you have a full carrier, a push operation creates only one link. One new link. So the push operation here is complicated. The logic of it is complicated. You first check to see if the carrier ring is empty. And if it is, that's the case where you got to create two links and set it up like we just talked. The next case is you got to see if the carrier ring is full. You detect that by checking to see if last link arrow next link equals first link. If the carrier is full, then you got to create a new link, one new link, place it in at the right place, and store your data there. The third case is where you have a non-null and non-full carrier ring. And that's the case where pushback doesn't do any memory allocation at all. It just puts the data item in first free and increments first free in the next link. Top front is always the same, it just decrements. Well, it's always the same if you got an empty and non-empty buffer. Top front has to check to see if the buffer is empty, because, you know, it's logically nonsensical to pop an empty buffer. So if the buffer is non-empty, what top front does is just increment the first use pointer to the next link. Now, there is a way to get rid of all these links by issuing a separate command, and that would be the clear command. So what the clear command does is get rid of the entire, all the links in the carrier ring and make the carrier ring null. Wait a minute. I think I said that wrong. Scratch that. I said it wrong. Clear just makes it an empty buffer. I said that wrong. Clear will make it an empty buffer by taking, all it's got to do is set first free equals first used. And then the buffer will be empty. It's release that does the much more dramatic thing of getting rid of all the memory that's been allocated. So release will have to go through and delete all the allocated links and make the carrier null. So clear makes the buffer empty. Release makes the carrier null. Have no links. You'll notice that here so far we've only been talking about the public interface. But the implementation plan I've been discussing, we talked about what you have to have some terminology that you're willing to stick with before you can start thinking about this carefully. Null carrier, empty buffer, full carrier, size, and capacity. Going back through it, a null character means that there are no links allocated. And our logic, our implementation control logic is going to be such that both buffer pointers are zero. So you can check either one of them. What this means is you can check either first free or first front, or first use. And if either one of those is zero, then A, the other one also is zero, and B, you got a null carrier. Empty buffer it's detected by either having a null carrier or the first used link is the same as the first free link. A full carrier is detected by the first free link is the only free link. And we said you could check that by taking the first free link, looking at its next link, and seeing if that's equal to the first used link. Finally, the number of elements currently stored in the buffer is the size. The capacity is either zero, and that's the case for a null carrier ring. So the capacity is how many items can you store in the carrier ring total. You can store zero items in a null carrier ring, or one less than the number of links in the carrier ring. And notice that the carrier ring can never have just one link. So capacity zero is the null carrier case. Capacity one is the case where the carrier ring has two links in it. Capacity two, the carrier ring has three links, and so on. The reason it's one less is we can't maintain our logic of the implementation plan without having one unused link somewhere in that ring to separate the beginning from the end of the buffer data. So now, here's the implementation plan for ring buffer. It's going to use a blink or B link, a buffer link, contains a T element called value and a pointer to type B link called next. It's going to have a one parameter constructor that initializes, it takes one parameter which is a type T element. What it does is initialize its value data to that incoming T val and initializes its pointer next to B0. So that right there is a complete implementation of that class. Notice that every element of that class, every member of that class is private, and therefore only its friends can get to anything. And its friends are ring buffer and ring buffer iterator. Here are the first used pointer and the first free pointer. They're each pointer to B links, like we were discussing earlier. I have a function here called clone, which is labeled too dangerous for public use. So you have to have a license for this thing. And it's therefore in the private sector. What clone does is make this buffer a copy of the incoming buffer. Clone will be called by the copy constructor and the assignment operator. There's a little comment here. The push, pop, clear, and release operations may make iterators illegitimate. This is something that can be true in general in container classes. You have to be very careful with iterators. If you define an iterator and then you manipulate the actual data in the container, there is a chance that the iterator previously defined is no longer valid iterator. Just think about it. In a linked list environment, you have an iterator pointing to, let's say, the third element in a list. Well, first of all, you could delete the third element in the list, and that iterator would then be pointing to a link that has been deallocated and now belongs to the memory for that link. The destruct has been called for it, first of all, and the memory has been given back to the operating system. So that obviously would be a case for them. But another case would be in linked lists, if it's pointing to some element other than the one that got deleted, then you actually don't invalidate the iterator, because the link only changes in a linked list when you deallocate that particular item. In a vector, for example, you could have a vector iterator pointing to the third element in a vector, and it could have 100 elements in it, and you push back a 101st element on this vector, and that caused a call to the set capacity function, which has to double the capacity of that vector to make room for that pushback. Well, if you recall how that works, ultimately all the memory that was allocated to that vector gets deallocated, and the vector gets rebuilt in another place with twice as much allocated memory. Well, that will invalidate every iterator that was pointing into the old vector. One of the reasons DEX came about, other than being able to put stuff at the front, which is nice, but one of the reasons DEX came about is so that the iterators remain valid better than they do with vectors and DEX. And I'll talk about that when we talk about DEX. But anyway, there's always, you always have to be very careful when you have iterators into containers and the containers are modified. There's always the potential for an iterator to go invalid on you. Now, the ring buffer iterator is just like a list iterator. Data consists of one pointer to a link, and we call it current. Not supported are the minus minus operators. You don't even need to put those in the private section, really. But there's a certain element of extra safety in doing that. If somehow a compiler managed to think that it was smart enough to decide on some default notion of minus minus, it would certainly not be the correct one. And you wouldn't want that to happen. And so if you put the prototypes in the private sector, that'll guarantee that if a client program attempts to use them, they'll get a compile error. There'll be something like you're trying to use a private method. Of course, when you put them in here, you never have to implement them either. You never get to the stage of needing the implementation. You get the compile error just from the fact that the declaration is in the private sector request. So let's go over these implementation nodes. There are three cases in implementing pushback. We talked about all three of those. If the buffer is not empty, pop front should increment the first use pointer, otherwise do nothing. One thing I forgot to mention up here pushback and pop front return Boolean values, which is basically they return them one if the operation was successful and a zero if the operation was not successful.
How come it's not a bool that you got listed as an exception?
I just haven't upgraded.
Oh, so
I haven't upgraded.
Insignificant question.
I sort of like having a few reminders that C is still a valid language, although I believe the new 2000 standard for C introduces Boolean type in C as well. People will be spinning in their graves over that one, probably.
Look at them either way. Then.
Yeah. If you want to use bool types, that's okay.
That's just what I'm used to seeing now. I'm getting that really matters.
Then we can get you off the subject. Can you log into Diablo?
Can I log into Diablo? Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you mean right this second?
Yeah. I wanted to see something.
I think I am at logged in.
Well, because right now it's telling us that the RAID file systems are being checked and won't be available till late Thursday night.
Yeah.
Can't save any work that we've done.
Yeah.
Can't even access anything that's on there. Our home directories are going.
Why did it tell you that?
While you were lecturing on this, the server crashed and then came back up, and right on shell it's saying RAID file systems are being checked and will be unavailable until late Thursday night.
Oh, well, that's shell. Oh, okay. That's going to be...
But it's the same thing on program, too.
Yeah.
When I try and save, it says no such directory exists.
We had dead man.
That's right.
Sorry, we regret the inconvenience. I'm going to give them some inconvenience.
Yesterday morning, early.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, a lot of data.
That's, I don't know if Diablo is on a different file system or not.
It must be.
That's terrifying. So I mean, I can't tell you how many files I've modified today. But I would hate to go back to yesterday's version.
The majority of my IPAA file I did today.
Yeah.
If they roll it back, I got to start that whole file over again by tomorrow night. I'm going to go to Tallahassee and talk to these people.
Yeah, that'd go far.
With a big bat.
Well, this is one of the things they do a very good job at. They don't do a good job with thinking about user needs when they do things like reinstall Emacs and forget to set it up the way it was before and everybody's files get screwed up. But taking care of the really serious problems, they're very good at. They will do their best to restore whatever. I haven't seen the message. I don't know what's happened. And, of course, I'm always flexible about deadlines, especially, when things like this happen. But let's just see how long it is and how much of a disaster it is before we talk about that.
Everything you've done all semester is gone. What do you think?
So, clear does not change the carry ring. Only buffer pointers are changed to make the buffer ring. Release actually releases all the dynamically allocated memory with the carrier ring. Release is called by the destructor and the assignment operator. Y'all see that? Note five is begin. Oh, should have repeated you. Begin return an iterator pointing to the beginning of the buffer. That should be obvious, right? So end returns an iterator pointing to one past the end of the buffer. Note that first three points to the link one past the last buffer element. So end can return the iterator with current equals first three. Also know that this is different from the usual expectation that end iterator is null, because there are no zero next pointers in a non-null carrier ring. End arrow current has a non-zero value. So here is a situation where you can write a loop, you can write a for loop and use valid to test for termination of the loop, and that will never terminate because the iterator will always be valid. There are ways we could fix this. This is the playground that I've made for you here. So the interesting thing will be that if you do an iteration for I equal buffer.begin, I dot valid plus plus I, that loop will run forever. On the other hand, you could do a loop that said for I equals buffer.begin I not equals buffer.in plus plus I, and that'll iterate exactly through the buffer. You can also iterate through the entire carrier ring as follows. Take an iterator I, initialize it to buffer.begin. So you write I equals buffer.begin. Increment it one time, plus plus I. And then continue the loop with a for loop. For the initialization's already been done. So the initialization thing will be empty. The continuation would be I not equal to begin plus plus I, and that will then continue all the way around the carrier ring until it gets back to where it started. Here are those two loops I was talking about. This is in any. So you have in a container class, iterator class, care must be taken to ensure that standard behavior expectations are implemented, or to inform client programmers of anomalies in behavior. Client programmers may have some expectation that these two loops are equivalent. First one goes from begin to end. Second one goes from